You know, it's not always about the leader charging with the flag and her or his followers kind of, you know, following in their way. In fact, that's the opposite of devolved leadership. It's about creating an environment where staff who want to do a good job, so that's the starting point. They go to work with the intention of doing a good job. And your role as a leader is to create an environment where they can do that. So you recruit people who like Andy Copsey in 2001, get intoxicated by this idea of taking responsibility off, because that's the point, that's the flip side of it. If you give me decision-making authority, then I also have to account for it if I get it wrong. So you leading from behind gives your staff the opportunity to grow and plot their own rule, as I say, within defined parameters, cultural parameters, not rules-based, principles-based parameters.
Hello and welcome to the Building Better Leaders podcast, brought to you by Scaffold Coaching. I'm Rachel Sullivan.
And I'm John Tattersall.
Hello and welcome to the Building Better Leaders podcast. Today, I'm absolutely delighted, along with Rachel, to welcome onto the show Andy Copsey, a long-standing friend. I think, Andy, we go all the way back to when we were 17, working at Yorkshire Bank Market Branch. And you've had various leadership roles, but particularly the one that we're going to talk to you about today is with Handelsbanken UK. So, Andy, welcome to the show. Would you just like to introduce yourself to our listeners?
Thanks, John. Yeah, we do go way back. It was 1983 when we first met and you started leading me astray, talking about leadership, but we won't go into that just now. Yeah, so I've only had two employers in the last 38 years of my banking career. I was at Yorkshire Bank for 18 years and then at Handelsbanken for the last 20 years. And I've been fortunate to have had kind of considerable leadership exposure throughout the majority of those 38 years. But I guess it is particularly interesting to talk about the Handelsbanken experience because that's a company with a peculiar, unusual culture and resultant organizational structure. Having said that, you know, my leadership journey did start a long time before Handelsbanken came along, and leadership generally is something that, whilst I'm not really an academic, I have thought about a lot. I've put a lot of thought into it because I've been fortunate enough to work with lots of good leaders, but equally with a few that were maybe not so good.
Yeah, yeah. And when you think back to sort of those days, so we're talking about beginning of the 90s, probably when we started to get like exposure to leaders, if you like. What were your sort of first experiences of that?
I think back then people didn't talk as much about leadership as they did about management. Having said that, we were encouraged, those youngsters in banking at the time, to study at college and at university to gain our banking exams. And some of the modules talked about organizational structures and certainly talked about people management and management generally. And what struck me was what I was kind of learning at Park Lane College on a wet Tuesday night in November wasn't necessarily being implemented by all of the managers / leaders that I was exposed to, including managers who had passed these exams that I was studying. And, you know, some fairly basic things like, you know, Maslow's hierarchy of needs, kind of starting to understand, you know, what makes human beings tick and how important it is for organizational success to be, you know, that you should be an effective leader. And I guess in whatever sector you happen to be in, if the organization is going to achieve its objectives, it's really going to achieve them through people, and therefore leading people was especially important. And one of the things that struck me from very early in my career was that leaders are appointed by the staff. When you become a manager, you get a kind of pay rise, you get a title, you maybe get a badge, I don't know, you get a different plaque, maybe even a parking space at work or some kind of outward recognition. But it, the staff decide who the leaders are. They're the people that I was gravitating towards when I wanted help and I wanted to learn the right way of being a banker. And of course, back then, and thankfully things have improved, but the majority of managers were men, but the majority of leaders that you and I, John, worked alongside were female. They weren't managers typically, but they were absolutely leaders who the staff and the customers turned to when they wanted things doing.
I can think of quite a few in charge of data processing people who absolutely filled that leadership role, didn't they? We did look up to them, and we sort of had to because they were quite stern with us. It sort of made you quite a resilient person, I think.
Yeah, I think they were trying to lead us in the right direction, and the organisation that we worked for was very focused on doing the right thing, especially for customers. Customers make paydays possible was one of the posters in the staff room. So it was all very kind of principle-led, and it was always striving to do the right thing and to achieve the right standards. And I learned a heck of a lot from those people, and have done throughout my career. I've been meeting leaders who are not managers for the last 38 years. It's still a phenomena, and it's still the case that some people in management don't really understand, in my view, that being a leader is a privilege. And it brings with it obligations. It's not just about getting a bit more pay or recognition or that badge on your lapel or that you know, larger car allowance or whatever it might be. Being privileged enough to be appointed a leader gives you the opportunity to materially impact on your colleagues' lives. And hopefully, of course, you'd like to think you'd be doing that in a positive way, but it is an obligation, and it's not something that you should take lightly, and it's not something you should opt out of. For example, if you're having a bad day or if you're under a little bit of pressure yourself.
Yeah, and I think you are right as well to sort of make that distinction between management and leadership. I mean, when we were working in the bank back then, you had your bank manager was the sort of the focal point, the guy who managed to get behind a curtain at lunch just to separate them from all the rest of the people that were in the bank. But I really like the idea about thinking of quite a few other people, and like you say, mainly women, who were the actual leaders in the branch that were getting all the work done, making sure that you were serving all the customers in the right way while they were basically out at lunch. And I'm not saying that's for that every manager was like that, but it was almost like once they'd got there, it was a fair amount of entitlement.
Yeah, I think you're right, John. And the other thing that struck me as well was because it was typical that you would move around a lot, and i.e. from branch to branch and maybe into the head office and out of the head office, etc. And I, in Yorkshire Bank, travelled extensively from West Yorkshire to North Yorkshire and to South Yorkshire. I was a real globetrotter in those days. And what struck me was the difference in leadership style that was required, in particular when I moved from the York branch in North Yorkshire to the Doncaster branch in South Yorkshire. And when I look back now, and because I knew I needed a different leadership style, but I probably more reflected on it afterwards, you know, why was that the case? Well, York as a city had come through a kind of post-industrial changes, and had fared better than Doncaster. York, has got a booming tourist industry. So they had a future to look forward to that was more difficult to see in South Yorkshire, where the closure of the mines had decimated the pit villages that were really proud, strong communities where people looked out for each other, they worked together, they socialised together. And those, the staff in those branches viewed me as a young manager quite differently. And I had in particular to be very sensitive to the fact, because the banks are still very hierarchical organisations generally, and this whippersnapper, at the ripe old age of 21, had got a job that people had thought they deserved because they'd been waiting longer than I had. And they were typically men, and they were probably in their 30s and wondered, who I was. And that was a challenging period from a leadership perspective, because I was an outsider coming in. And I've always been, I like to think, a kind of fairly down-to-earth and approachable person, but I kind of had to go a few steps beyond that in terms of empathizing with where they were coming from. But also, one of the things that I think has always been important is being good at your job. It's really important, in my view at least, if you're a leader or a manager or both, to be able to illustrate that you have the technical skills to do the job, and to be willing to lean forward and do what needs to be done, so that you don't put yourself on a pedestal. You're not in your office. You're not in an ivory tower. You are very much working alongside your colleagues and building up interpersonal relationships. And like I say, showing that you can do the job, and quite probably it's a job that you have yourself personally done before. And that really, in my experience, helps with relationship building, takes some of the sting out of any negativity that there might be. And, and I've got, lifelong friends from those days who didn't necessarily start off particularly friendly.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because I think back then, progression within the organisation was all about service. It was length of service. You've been here long enough, so now you're going up a grade. Yeah. And along comes this young whippersnapper who's sort of overtaking. Rachel, I mean, you're a Donny lass, the miners' strike and all that. Be a very difficult place for somebody at age 21 to go from.
I can only imagine. I mean, I probably would have been about 4 at the time when you were working in.
Forget that we're this old by comparison.
I know, when you said 1983, I was like, I'm born in 1982. But my mum actually worked in the Yorkshire Bank in Doncaster about that time. Ooh. I am wondering if your paths would have crossed. she's sadly no longer with us now, so I can't ask her, but I can only imagine. But what I'm struck with, actually, by hearing you explain that, and I'm imagining that people that are listening to this, still not knowing yet where your leadership journey has took you after that, is how does a 21-year-old have that much empathy, consideration, compassion, but also that drive and wisdom? Because I know you're talking about traveling extensively from south to north to west Yorkshire, but actually back then that was as foreign as going to London for work on a daily basis. I remember during the miners' strike being walked everywhere, like literally walking from Hatfield into Doncaster, and it used to take us all day because there were no buses. But where does that come from? What was it that you were, was it seeing people at 17 and been influenced by that? Or was there something in you that knew you wanted to be a leader even at a younger age?
It's a good question. I think everybody's story, of course, starts in childhood, doesn't it? And I don't know whether it's relevant or not, or whether it, well, I'm sure it shaped me, but I'm the youngest of 11 children.
Wow.
So, from a working class background, my dad was a police constable. He never wanted to become a detective or anything other than be a bobby on the beat. And obviously, having 11 children, my mum was quite busy too. but it didn't stop her adopting two more and being a crossing lady, lollipop lady for 25 years. So, you know, none of my siblings work in professions such as, you know, financial services, banking or law, or et cetera, they've many and varied jobs and have all been incredibly successful, you know, in the chosen careers. So any suggestion that Andy Copsey, you know, had some, grand dreams about who he was, you know, how well he'd done, you know, how he would respond to being in a position of authority, you know, he was all shaped by my upbringing and having five elder brothers to keep you in check if it was necessary, if you looked like you were getting too big for your boots. So, that must have had an impact. And as it happens, Rachel, I was actually born in one of those pit villages in Doncaster when my dad had been transferred there with the police force from West Yorkshire. Now he moved back again, but I heard, and I moved back when I was very, very young. But I know the stories of the proud pit villages, and I'd see, because I'd arrived after, and we'd all seen the news, you know, we'd seen what had happened during the miners' strike. So I think I had that empathy for a number of reasons, not least because, you know, I could have been brought up in Doncaster, and my brothers could have been, and my sisters, affected by the economic downturn that impacted on obviously not just on South Yorkshire, but on the mining sector across the UK. And I think that's always been in the back of my mind, that nothing's forever, and you really do have to keep your skills up and have to remain relevant and commercially successful, because the days of nationalized industries and jobs for life, even in banking, we'll come to that later, ended some time ago.
Yeah, so a natural inquisitiveness and sensitivity to an environment. So talk us through your progression through Yorkshire Bank and how you ended up to become so senior in Handelsbank.
Well, I think the career path back then in Yorkshire Bank was, as John described it, typically you did a number of years in a role and then you moved to the next one. But I think it's fair to say that passing my professional qualifications early in my tenure took me from a big pool of the staff that they recruited in 1983 at 16 years of age, i.e. me. They were open about there being a ceiling, not a glass ceiling. It was a ceiling that was there. And if you did really well, you could become a senior cashier. But thankfully, they were smart enough to understand that if somebody had, in their own time and spending their own money, had gone to college and got the banking qualifications, then maybe they had something about them. And that's why at the ripe old age of 21, I had so much experience compared to, for example, the graduates that were coming in that were supposed to go right to the top really quickly, but inevitably they still had to learn banking. So I think that helped me. And I worked for some managers who presumably, and back then jobs weren't advertised. So, and that was one of the problems when it came to equality, and I'm thinking in particular gender equality. Mm. You just got a phone call and you'd been promoted.
Right.
There was no job advert. There was no open interview process. There was no interview at all. It doesn't please me to say it, because, I mean, as it happens, I met my wife whilst sat on a counter cashiering in a branch of Yorkshire Bank, and I could see, and she left very, very shortly afterwards because she could see that being a female in banking, you weren't going to progress. She was doing the same exams as me, but sadly, they lost an awful lot of talent and equally wasted a lot of talent because they didn't always promote the right people because they were only promoting from the male gene pool without a shadow of a doubt. So I think I did a reasonable job and I became a branch manager in the traditional old-fashioned sense of a branch when I was like 26 in Hunslet, which is in Leeds. It's a suburb in Leeds. And I took a team that was, there was a league table at the time. There was something like 250th in the league table. Mm-hmm. And we got to number four in the league table. I don't necessarily believe in league tables, but that's how that organisation benchmarked its branches. So then in 2001, I got a phone call out of the blue with somebody telling me about a Swedish bank called Handelsbanken, who, to be honest, I'd never heard of. But when they started talking and explaining the culture of the organisation, and in particular around the devolved leadership model, that really caught my imagination. And you know, I had no intention of leaving the Yorkshire Bank, but I found the opportunity to kind of start from an entrepreneurial perspective, my own business in an organization that would give me more empowerment on the day I started than I'd accrued in the previous 18 years at my old employer. I thought that was a really interesting challenge and a really interesting opportunity. And I took it in the blink of an eye, really. I mean, as a banker, where you're used to kind of spreadsheets and doing risk analysis and all that good stuff, it was, to be frank, very much a gut reaction to say, yeah, I want to work in this way. And if I don't take this opportunity, it might never come along again.
Andy, I think it's really sort of poignant, isn't it, that you talked at the end about sort of leaving Yorkshire Bank and the sort of the inequities, the diversity, the inclusion, the inequality, and what have you, and yet you find yourself working for a Swedish organisation who, by culturally, they are much more in it's a more feminine approach. And by that, I mean more of a collective approach rather than a masculine kind of culture. And it's really interesting to talk about that devolved leadership that comes out of that, because that was actually sort of like black and white in terms of what you'd come from and what you were going to.
Yeah, absolutely, John. I'd been a branch manager, as I said before, at Yorkshire Bank, and I was now a branch manager in Handelsbanken. But the only thing that was the same, really, was the title. The extent to which... So if I kind of go back a little bit, because I think it's interesting to talk about where this culture came from, because there is a Swedish aspect to it, but actually this devolved leadership model is not a Swedish thing. It was introduced to that organisation by a chap called Jan Wallander in the early 1970s. And Wallander was an economist. So he was looking at this model as being a blueprint for commercial success. He felt that if you really believe what lots of organizations say, which is our best asset is our staff. Without our staff, you would never achieve anything. It's all over the mission statements and the glossy annual reports of very many companies. And Wallander said, if we believe that, we have to follow this through in the structure of the organization. And that organization, like very many organizations, was very centralized. It had very many layers of management, and people in head office had all the power, because that's the way of the world, isn't it? But it hadn't been commercially successful for a number of years. So Wallander said, I will become your CEO, providing you allow me to implement and follow through all the implications of trust and respect for your staff. And thankfully, the then shareholders agreed to bring Jan Vollander on board. So wind the clock forward from kind of 1971 or so to 2001 in the UK, and Handelsbanken has decided to expand its UK branch network and starts with a couple of, let's call them pilot branches, one of which was in Leeds. And to see if this model that had been commercially successful and showed really high levels of staff engagement would work in the UK. And I knew it would, because, you know, the people that I'd worked with over the years who had been frustrated by a centralized rules-led organization would absolutely flourish and succeed in a principles-led organization where the decisions were made in the local branches. And I'm sure that, you know, there will be people listening to this podcast thinking that sounds crazy. How could you possibly, especially the highly regulated sector like banking, you know, let people like Andy Copsey make decisions in his branch about who he lends money to and at what rate? That sounds a recipe for disaster. Only if you don't trust people and if you don't have guiding principles that are, by the way, immovable. So that was the opportunity that I grasped, and really that's what then myself and many others, of course, propelled Handelsbanken in the UK from being a 5-branch bank into, you know, the 200 branch network that they've got now. And I was, you know, fortunate enough to be at the centre of effectively implementing Jan Vollander's principles in the UK. And of course, people in the UK responded just like Scandinavians do, both the staff and the customers, because customers love dealing with people who can make decisions. And the decision isn't necessarily, yes, you can have your mortgage, Mr. Copsey, but at least if the decision is made by the person that you can influence and they can rationalize that decision, and can look you in the eye and, you know, and explain it in a professional manner. And, you know, pleasingly during that 20-year journey with Handelsbanken, like I say, many customers and many staff were receptive to that message, and I was very much at the heart of communicating that message and implementing it in a commercially successful way.
I think, Andy, that this is a bit of a rhetorical question, really. It seems such a simple model that how, in the way that you've explained it, that why wouldn't it work? But you mentioned the word trust in there. Do you think that, you know, it is a highly regulated industry, even more so now than it was back in 2001 for certain? But do you think it was just that element of the UK approach was one of power, authority, and basic lack of trust, whereas it was quite the opposite with Handelsbanken?
Yeah, I wouldn't say it's a UK or a Swedish thing, because there are, you know, the normal structure of a corporate in Sweden, i.e. centralised, that prevails in Sweden. Handelsbanken's an outlier. It's nothing to do with the sector. It's nothing to do with the country. It's down to Jan Vollander implementing it and proving that it's commercially successful. In the intervening 50 years, you know, the Handelsbanken share price has performed very well. Customer satisfaction ratings have been very high, and same for staff engagement. So why wouldn't you do it? And of course, between 2001 and where we are today, there's been a global banking crisis. And many people ask the question, what were the leaders doing in these organizations? What happened? What were the root causes of what happened? And in my view, you know, leadership was the leaders of those banks led in a certain way and created a certain culture that pitted colleagues against each other with targets and bonuses, which is very much contrary to the collaborative empowerment devolved leadership model that that Handelsbanken had implemented. And surprise, surprise, Handelsbanken sailed through the global financial crisis. So, you know, that model that was introduced 50 years ago that I'm sure many people thought looked dangerous has actually been the key to its resilience, stability, predictability, all that stuff that you want from banks. You know, you want banks where you put your savings. None of us will ever forget. None of us that saw it will ever forget the queues outside Northern Rock. We've not seen a bank run for a long time. So it turns out that trusting very many people to run the organization is considerably safer than putting all of your trust into a very small number of people, in this case at the top of banks. And of course, very few of them, you know, there were very few consequences for the people who had led those banks in a way that led to a global financial crisis. And that's why, as you said, John, that's why the regulators reacted in lots of different ways, but in terms of culture, in looking at the culture of these organizations and tried to work out what went wrong and how we could prevent it happening again. But interestingly, certainly in the large UK high street banks, there has not been a move towards a decentralized or devolved leadership model.
Why do you think that is, Andy?
That's a good question, Rachel. I think, you know, some of these organizations are super tankers and they take some turning. And this goes right to the heart of my view around leadership. I've kind of mulled over the years about this kind of principle of leading from the front. But I also like to think about leading from behind. You know, it's not always about the leader charging with the flag and her or his followers kind of, you know, following in their wake. In fact, that's the opposite of devolved leadership. It's about creating an environment where staff who want to do a good job, so that's the starting point. They go to work with the intention of doing a good job. And your role as a leader is to create an environment where they can do that. So you recruit people who like Andy Copsey in 2001, get intoxicated by this idea of taking responsibility off, because that's the point. That's the flip side of it. If you give me decision-making authority, then I also have to account for it if I get it wrong. So you leading from behind gives your staff the opportunity to grow and plot their own rule, as I say, within defined parameters, cultural parameters, not rules-based, principles-based parameters. So to introduce that to an organization with 50 or 100,000 people, where actually you've not trained up your staff to have those skills, could be dangerous. So coming back to your question, Rachel, maybe the reason, and I don't know because I've never been privy to these board meetings in these UK banks, maybe the reason that they haven't gone for a devolved leadership model is that it would take too much effort and maybe create too much risk to empower people who, for years, you've been telling them to hit sales targets and you've incentivized them with bonuses. And bonuses, for me, all they do is reinforce the fact that we think that you only really work for money because that's the only carrot that we've got. How do you change that culture in a big organization? And maybe you find that you've got a cohort of staff. You've created the monster. You develop the leaders in the style of the very powerful CEOs that those organizations had. And it could be quite difficult, and I'd say quite risky, to suddenly give somebody autonomy to make decisions when they don't have the skill set.
I wonder just with what you were saying then, you know, having worked for a couple of big, like massive corporations, is that I think leaders in companies that are that big think they do more than they do. And actually, really, the strength of the culture is so binding to the ways things are done that the organization almost leads it runs itself. And the new leadership team comes in and thinks that they really do make changes or lead things. And really, actually, and you know, great inspirational leaders say, oh, I'm just a custodian of this role or whatever. But actually, literally, you are, because you could be anybody and things would still happen.
Yeah.
And so I wonder if there's exactly what you just said, but also it's such a beast now that there's no taming it. Maybe. Yeah.
And it seems that the natural way of the world, as I said before, Rachel, is for organisations to centralise. Surely the power should be in head office. Surely that's where all the staff would want to work. That, you know, surely there should be layers of management. So actually, in a decentralised organisation, you must work very hard to resist the temptation to allow things to become centralised, because they will.
Yeah.
You have to take your hands off. You have to implement what I describe as this leading from behind, you know, making sure that people understand that the cultural and principles, culture and principles of the organization, but don't tell them in minute detail how to do their job. And you know what? Maybe they can do that job better than you can anyway. And maybe by observing what they do, you might learn as well. But the environment's crucial. Because if your organization is a place where, you know, failure is punished, you know, you're not encouraged to do anything outside the norm. And we've all had it in our personal life where, you know, you're dealing with a supplier or whatever, and they won't do something that seems entirely reasonable and sensible. And you can tell that the person wants to do it, but they're not allowed. I mean, how demotivating is that? So you have to, it has to be a conscious effort to maintain this devolved leadership model. And if you take your eye off the ball, you'll look around and things will have started to creep back to head office where, you know, where they seem to know best. And when it comes to banking, that's quite dangerous. And, you know, one of the learnings from the financial crisis was that the banks that failed and the building societies as well that failed usually because of one or two very big decisions made at a board level. It wasn't because the branches per se were doing anything wrong. You know, PPI, the obvious one, was obviously those organisations drove that from the centre. And that was, you know, that's resulted in, I don't know, I've lost count, is it £30 billion worth of redress for the UK banking sector? I mean, huge consequences for an inappropriate sales culture on one product set.
It was so much, Andy, wasn't it, that it was affecting the GDP figures?
Yeah.
It was driving an economy.
That's right, yeah. People were buying new cars and putting extensions on them.
Seems paradoxical, isn't it, really?
Yeah. So I think...
Yeah, I'm just thinking about this devolved leadership, and you've explained around it and the pull of the centralized control, but talk us through how, you know, you go from starting in this new role where you're leading one of five branches from behind, and then you said it ended up being today it's 200 branches. What happened in that journey? Talk us through that journey and how that resisting the pull of centralized control plays out, because it's just such a fascinating story of you hear it talked about so much, but there's not very many demonstrations of it thriving.
Yeah, I mean, I guess a big part of my role was to talk about you know, the culture of the organization to people who were, who by definition were working in a completely different culture. And this goes the same for customers, of course, because the commercial success of any organization, it depends on you being able to attract customers with pretty much the same message. And it comes back to this kind of, you know, human beings. It's not just because we've got a lot of Viking DNA in the north of England still, that this seemingly Scandinavian idea worked. It's because people want to deal with people who can make decisions, and staff want to be empowered to do the right thing for customers. So a big part of my role in the early 2000s really was spreading the message and communicating that it can be, you can do things differently. Because why, and you asked the question earlier, Rachel, if it's commercially successful and if it makes sense on all sorts of levels, well, why don't other organisations do it? So I had to explain and convince people that it was doable. I was able to evidence it because it had been happening since the early 70s. And really it was about bringing like-minded people on board and helping them to really understand what that means, especially this responsibility bit. You know, if you make decisions, you can't point to somebody else. You can't say it was head office. Well, it wasn't, was it? It was you. You made the decision. And what you do is people repay that faith in spades. So they work harder, more diligently, because they have found an environment where somebody trusts them and they respond very positively to that. So over the early 2000s, the Handelsbank and Leeds branch was kind of spawning other branches. And one of the proudest things in my career has been the fact that of the cohort that I recruited at that time, 8 of those recruits went on to be branch managers of their own and into other senior management positions. So it grew organically. And then this crisis came along, and banks, economies usually have recessions every 10 or 15 years. So it was not unexpected. The severity of it took everybody by surprise, of course, in 2008 and 2009, and especially the impact on the banks. But it transpired, as I said before, that a bank that had been run by its staff effectively in a devolved leadership model performed better and didn't need to be bailed out by taxpayers or even its own shareholders. So that kind of turbo boosted Handelsbanken's growth in the UK. And that's at that point, I stopped being a branch manager and became an area manager to help expand the branch even more outside of Yorkshire. And then a couple of years later, when the branch numbers were probably getting into the 120, 140 bracket, I became the UK Chief Operating Officer. And in that particular organisation, they value people with frontline experience being in those senior management positions, even ones that might be a little bit, if you like, detached from banking as you might understand it. So, for instance, you know, I was responsible for the IT department, which, you know, I'm not a techie. I was responsible for the communications department and so on. But having that linkage from the front of the organisation, the branches, to the back of the organisation, if you like, the head office, was very valued by Handelsbanken, because they wanted to make sure that head office really was serving the branches and responding to the branches', you know, reasonable requests for product development and system development and so on. So I have to say that was a steep learning curve, and especially in 2008 and 2009 when the crisis had hit, and you know everybody was wondering what had happened and which bank was going to be next and how can that bank be doing so well and what lessons can we learn. There was a lot of interest from politicians and financial journalists and financial influencers generally to understand how an organisation that trusted its staff could have fared so well compared to the centralised organisations with the kind of powerful people at the top. who had been driving the share price in those organisations through the growth period since 2001.
It's amazing. And is it, talk us through, well, I'm just going to ask you, is it true then that nobody in Handel's Banking is rewarded with bonuses? Like, how does the pay structure and reward system work then? Because that, even when you said that in itself, just seems so not what we expect from somebody that works in banking.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've had that conversation, Rachel, with very many people, especially potential recruits who, you know, in the early 2000s, they were saying, yeah, but I get paid this bonus and it's a lot of money. And why would I give that up for this different package? And I kind of respond by saying, you know, and let's say I'm talking to somebody from a bank that's working for a bank that's 300 years old. And there are banks in the UK that are 300 years old. And I kind of said, well, for how many of the 300 years did the staff require bonuses to set their alarm clock on a morning? And it was a very recent phenomenon. So I didn't feel the need to justify why bonuses were necessary. I would just replay that to them and say, you know, for the first 280 years of that bank's existence, they didn't pay bonuses. And it worked out all right, didn't it? And then they introduced bonuses. And some people say that was a feature of what happened in the run-up to the global financial banking crisis. So it comes back to this point about, do you believe that your staff go to work to do a good job or not? And you obviously, in a commercial environment, you have to pay a satisfactory package in the round. If you don't, then you're going to find it very difficult to get the staff you need to run your business, whatever sector you're in. But of course, in banking, which does, as I mentioned before, suffer probably more than some sectors when it comes to the economic cycle, the time when you really want people to roll the sleeves up and when you really test their mettle is when things are going wrong. And you're busy kind of trying to keep the lights on and, you know, stabilize the organization. And that's not when banks pay bonuses. So just at the point where people are going to have to work harder, their remuneration is going to drop, which is going to be demotivational. So it kind of, if you want to create a stable environment where the economic cycles are kind of, you know, the peaks are maybe chopped off, but certainly the troughs are shallower, then you go for this stable, secure environment. And when Verlander introduced this devolved leadership model in the early 70s, he also introduced a profit-sharing scheme. And the profit-sharing scheme meant that if the bank hit certain profitability targets, the staff would get a share of, if you like, that surplus profit. And these profitability targets were relative to their peer group. So if that bank made a better job of riding out a recession than the sector did, and it might not have been a very good job, but it was better, you know, because that's sometimes in business, that's all you can hope for. You know, we didn't need a bailout in the financial crisis. That's a result. It would have been nice to see the profit grow, but we didn't need a bailout from shareholders or government. So the relative profit target resulted in a surplus profit, and part of that surplus went to the staff, and the staff got the same whether they'd been in the bank a year as a junior or whether they were the group CEO. So it was this real togetherness, and that money went into Handel's Banking shares, and you only got access to your fund when you turned 60.
It's a really interesting view, isn't it? How it's turned around. For anyone who's listening to this then, Andy, and we'll give you your contact details later if they want to sort of follow up with you. What would be the starting point for somebody who wants to run an organization that is just a lot more around the devolved leadership? Where do they actually start? Because you've probably piqued a few people's interest with this.
Yeah, I think it's very much about being able to express the cultural environment that, you know, if it's a startup, you know, what cultural environment do you want to create? And being very determined not to be knocked off track. So I mentioned before about the peaks and troughs of an economic cycle. If your organization is maybe run in a more safe fashion, then maybe you don't quite hit the peaks. And at that point, your detractors are saying, well, I told you so. Why don't you pay bonuses? If you've got bonuses, you better get better people, which, as I mentioned before, I don't think is true. But so you have to stick to your principles. And that is tough sometimes. Because there will be people. I remember quite in the early part of my tenure as the branch manager in Leeds, I was invited by the Institute of Chartered Accountants, England and Wales, to do a talk on the devolved leadership model. And part of the devolved leadership model, which I've not touched on so far, that Valander introduced was to do away with budgets. So I'm stood in front of a group of chartered accountants who, you know, presumably believe in budgets. Yeah. And I'm telling them that you don't need a budget to run a successful organisation.
Mm.
So you have to be prepared. A lot of this is about communication, standing up for your principles and rationalising them and explaining why you believe. And I don't tell people that they should run their organisation in a devolved leadership model. I just say this is one way of running an organisation. There are other ways. But I think if you want to attract entrepreneurial people and people who really want to be challenged, then a devolved leadership model could work for you. And especially in this world where technology is moving so quickly, the bosses don't have the answers. So let's stop pretending. You know, if you can recruit good people with a different brain who have got the potential to maybe pretty quickly, if not on day one, go beyond you, that's fantastic. Gone are the days where the boss needs to be the know-all, the person that's got all the answers. That's not going to work in a fast-moving tech-led world. And of course, you know, tech's touching every sector. And if you talk to young people now and you talk about, I think we touched on age before, Rachel, you said when I was 21, what's interesting is this is just as exciting to young people as it is to people of all ages and all backgrounds. Because what you're saying is, I trust you.
Mm.
Wow, that's pretty powerful.
Yeah, we had a psychologist on the podcast the other week, didn't we, Rachel? Graham Keane. And the thing that he was suggesting is that if you give people trust and you actually trust them to do the job, then you get discretionary effort. And I think that in itself means that people are just waking up when the alarm clock goes because they want to go to work because it's rewarding. It's not just about the pay, because you get to make decisions. And you get to shape other people's lives and their organisations.
I think where you have to be careful, if you start promising and talking about trusting people, they will hold you to account. So you have to follow through on it. Because if they feel let down and demotivated, then that's worse than working for an organisation. And you've never pretended to do any of that. They always said you just have to follow the rules. And then you can end up with staff who are disengaged, they go quiet, they don't put their hand up anymore, they don't actually, you know, if the organisation says something but their boss actually doesn't really want your opinion, then, you know, you end up with, in the worst case scenario, they stay, because I think that's the worst case, they stay and they become corporate ninjas. Second worst scenario is that they stay and just kind of plod along. And of course, you know, the worst scenario is that the your good people with all that creativity leave.
Yeah, I think that the mindset, or rather the transformational shift in this is what you said around it attracting entrepreneurial people, because that culturally, from a capitalist background, is what we're taught the opposite to believe. In fact, we're taught that if you're entrepreneurial, you will chase the bonus and you will find that kind of franchise business, or you will go and be a banker and chase the big paychecks and the big bonus structures. Mm-hmm. And actually what this model has proven is that actually it creates a culture of entrepreneurial people rather than rewarding and promoting the 5 or 6 extremely driven people in an organization to positions of absolute power.
Yeah.
That for me is the, I've never heard it explained like that before. I'd not thought about it like that.
And there are some maybe unexpected, or certainly they were unexpected for me, consequences that if you allow people to be themselves, then you're starting on a journey which is incredibly powerful from an equality, diversity, and inclusion perspective. Because if your start point is it's okay, Rachel, for you to do the job within the within the principles and the cultural structure of the organization, you can operate in whatever way you want, then actually you can be your true self at work. And if you can wrap around that, you know, supportive environment, and this is, if I'm being frank, something that, you know, in my 38-year tenure, I've only really cottoned onto in the last probably 5 or 6 years, the importance for society and for the organizational success and for the happiness of the staff to really proactively engage in equality, diversity, and inclusion. And what I mean by proactive, it's not enough just to be, you know, approachable and, you know, to have time for people and to be, you know, to be interested in their work-related ideas. It goes beyond that, because there are still people whose career potential is being restricted by their inability to really express themselves at work. And if you bring a devolved leadership model in to an organization, you really do have to make sure that all of your leaders really embrace that. Because without that hierarchical structure of reporting and kind of invasive management, what goes on in little pockets could be problematic. So as a leader, you really do have to step forward, in my view, in this area. And I've talked about leading from behind. I think this is an area where you need to lead from the front and bring people on a journey, because I think there's a lot of people that are still, like I've been, on that, you know, at the bottom of the curve before they've really started on the journey to understand what to do about this very important area.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
So, Andy, I think people will be interested to know how did your actual role at Handelsbanken finish, and what was Handelsbanken like when you actually left? Was it different to 2001? What was it like for you looking back across that sort of 20 years time span?
That's a good question. I mean, my tenure at Handelsbanken, I referred to the first two chapters of my career being Yorkshire Bank and Handelsbanken, and my third chapter, which is what I'm in now, started probably unexpectedly, shall we say. Having said that, I'm tremendously excited about the third chapter, and we'll touch on that in a moment. I think Handelsbanken was a startup when I joined it, and then it became a scale-up. And I think in many respects, it's probably at its optimum size in the UK. I'm talking about just crudely in terms of the number of branches, for example, and its geographic reach. So I think it's in a different phase of its evolution now. And I'm very happy to be embarking on this chapter three, which will see quite a material evolution, if not revolution, for me, having only worked in banking and only worked for two organisations. And I obviously, you know, wish Handelsbanken all the very, very best. But, you know, it was a shock. I'm not going to pretend otherwise. And, you know, you read a lot, and I've been a lot of seminars and such like, and read a lot of material about what happens to people in my case, early 50s, when they suddenly find themselves, you know, not needing to set the alarm clock. And that's been, you know, it's only 4 months since that happened, but I've managed to fill my time so far, and I'm very excited about what I've achieved so far, but also what the future might hold, having, you know, initially, quite frankly, gone through a bit of a disorientating period, but reflecting on what I've got to offer and how exciting the big wide world is.
Well, I think if anybody wasn't convinced already, having listened to this, Andy, they would only have to go on your LinkedIn profile and look at the number of comments that people left, the value of those comments when you had actually moved away from Handelsbanken. They were just amazing. You know, that you were obviously a very, very highly regarded leader. So what does Andy do now when he gets you? You've talked to me before about getting your 60 hours back in your life.
Yeah.
And you've come up with 6 things in 60 hours that you can do now that you didn't have the opportunities to do before.
Yeah. And I think I've always been quite active. So the 60 hours that I refer to is, people assume maybe that people that work in banks work from 9 to 5 for 5 days a week. But yeah, roughly speaking, over the last few years, I've probably been committing 60 hours a week to either being at work or commuting to and from work. So, I mean, I was the timing of it was quite fortunate in a bizarre way, because I mentioned before I'm from a big family, and I was very fortunate to be able to provide with my siblings palliative care to my mum, who was very poorly at the time. And that was a privilege, really, that I wouldn't have had, and a precious time that I'll treasure forever. So that's probably the most valuable thing that I did for a period of time with those 60 hours. Secondly, When you and I first met, John, in Leeds, we worked in a part of Leeds that's probably economically quite deprived. It was then, and it still is. Mm. And I decided that with my 60 hours, I would give something back. And I was introduced to a charity which is based in that part of Leeds called the Music and Arts Production. And they help young adults who are either excluded from school or at risk of exclusion. And I mean, I'm finding that really rewarding, actually. And it does feel a little bit more poignant than it happens to be where my career started many moons ago. And then thirdly, I wanted to find time to give something back on a larger scale than that very valuable but local charity. So me and a couple of friends last month, we cycled, we did a charity fundraiser for Save the Children. We cycled from Land's End to John O'Groats, which is over 1,000 miles. Bear in mind, I've never cycled more than, I think, 60 miles in any one ride before. That was quite a challenge. And so far, we've raised £7,000 for Save the Children. So that's been rewarding, and certainly, you know, my mind turns to what I'll do next. I've not decided yet, but I think I've been very fortunate in my career to have done, I guess, pretty well. And this opportunity, which was gifted to me, if gifted is the right word, I wanted to use, you know, positively. And then the fourth thing was to get fit, because as you said, John, when you're working long hours, you don't always get the opportunity to look after your body. So I now get out on my bike 2 or 3 times a week. I find it very sociable. I very rarely cycle, although when I cycle, usually with friends and family. And the physical well-being aspect is apparent, and so is the mental well-being. It's really tangible to be able to get out and get, you know, clear your head and see the beautiful countryside that we're fortunate enough to have in the UK. But then number five is to get back to work. Some people mistook or assumed perhaps that I would use this as an opportunity to kind of stop working in some way, shape or form. But I've always believed that work is important. It's important for society. It's important, and I don't just mean financially, but it's important for your own self-esteem and your own, you know, keep the old grey matter challenge, keep learning new skills, meeting new people. You know, the sociable aspect of work, I think, is really important. So basically, you know, number five is to set up my own little consultancy company and to work with people and businesses whose values chime with mine, and maybe help them achieve their ambitions by sharing some of my experiences across leadership, which is obviously what we're talking about today, but across a number of areas as well, from risk management and sales leadership and control environments and IT and, you know, technology, all sorts of things that hopefully, as I say, I can help other entrepreneurs to achieve their business goals and personal goals. And then last, really, number six is just to have a bit more time in my life. So I might not use all 60 hours on the other five items. Spend more time with my family and just maybe, you know, have a little bit of me time factored in to the working week. So, yeah, so that's my 1660, as I call it.
1660.
Andy, if I may, I'll just take you back to Handelsbank, and I've just got a couple of questions. So you were very senior when you ended your career or started this third period, but I'm just interested, in a devolved leadership model, what did they call you? Was it like an executive team? It just seems like the language doesn't match the culture. So what were you as this leadership team in a non-centralized called?
So the terminology changed over time, but the UK leadership team is probably the term that sums up the roles that I've fulfilled in the majority of the last kind of 13 years. And during that period, I was the UK chief operating officer for 9 of those years, and for a few months I was actually the acting UK CEO as well, which was interesting and enlightening and very rewarding as well. So the leadership team of Handelsbank and that oversaw and continues to oversee the growth and the continued development of that bank, because its story has got more chapters to go, but it's more that it's reached the level of maturity where I want now to be involved, probably in growth companies, scale up kind of businesses. I like building, and I like helping people to build and grow and, you know, and take on board new challenges.
And so that's interesting. Thank you for that, because it would have felt odd if you'd have said you were called an executive team, because it doesn't feel like it was that feel. But as you're preparing to leave an organisation like that, and I'm sure there's confidentiality bits that you can't tell us what the reasons were and how it happened, but as somebody that's worked since they were 16 to been in your 50s and only working for two organisations and having this identity as a banker, what was happening for you psychologically, and probably still is now, as you're transitioning from having this identity as Andy was the banker to now talk us through a little bit of that experience, because I don't think we talk about this enough, and this is why people don't stop or have heart attacks as soon as they do stop working, because they don't know what to do.
Yeah, no, I've always enjoyed working, as I said, and I'll continue to do so. But work's never defined me. So, you know, job titles, you know, pay rises, perceived or apparent power, that's never been what's motivated me. And it might, I don't know if people believe what I'm saying, but I've not kind of had this big knock to my self-confidence because Handelsbanken had a restructure and there wasn't a role for me in the new structure. That stuff happens. You know, people considerably worse off than me. So, you know, I just view it as an opportunity. And to like I said, to start this third chapter with all this fantastic experience that they gave me. They gave me the opportunity to grow and evolve and to experience international business, different cultures, and, you know, what it'd be like to work for, as I say, a scale-up company rather than a mature company, which is what Yorkshire Bank was. So I just view all that experience as a gift that I'm grateful for, and I'll use it, as I say, for the benefit of both in the charity sector and also in the commercial sector, and there's obviously a huge amount of overlap there. There's very many businesses want to find a way to do the right thing, but maybe need a little bit of guiding hand as to what to actually do. And the same in the D&I area, the diversity and inclusion. I think there's people worried about, you know, what if I get it wrong? Well, it's better to show your staff that you care and that you're trying to get it right. That's got to be a better start than burying your head in the sand. So yeah, it was. I'm not going to say it wasn't. I think the word I used was disorientating when it first happened. But I've said to very many bankers, especially the ones that I haven't recruited over the years, because you can't recruit everybody you interview, obviously. I've said you've got an incredible skill set as a banker. You know, you've done sales management, you've done leadership, you might have done risk and control, you've done analysis, you're probably pretty good with numbers, and you're usually pretty good with people as well. So there's a real toolkit there. And I read a really interesting article today that talked about the fact that people can now work from home, mean that people are less likely to retire at the same point. And it kind of reminded me that, you know, you accrue a hell of a lot of knowledge and information and skills. And if you suddenly stop, it's kind of a bit of a waste, really. Wouldn't it be better to keep paying back to society and helping the next generation? You made reference to senior leaders sometimes saying, I'm just the steward, you know, I'm just... you know, I'm here, and the organisation will survive, and of course they will, and they nearly always do. But I think that's right. I think you should leave an organisation in a better place than where you found it, and then you can leave with your head held high, and hopefully, like John very kindly said, your peers. I mean, I think your peer, the view of your peers is much more important than the view of your managers, because your peers know what you do. They see the extent to which you care about customers and each other. They see it day in, day out. You can't pull the wool over your peers' eyes, the people you work alongside. So, yeah, there were some really nice things said, and that just made me think, well, yeah, you know, I've passed the baton to somebody else, wish them all the very best, and, wow, I've got this exciting opportunity. To go again.
Andy, you talk about gifts, and you've given us a real gift today in agreeing to come on to the podcast. I don't think that we've had a podcast where there's going to be so many links. We'll put the link to that article that you're talking about, working from home and maybe retiring at a different time. We'll put that in as well. We always like to ask our guests if they will give us three leadership essentials. You've given us loads. I'm sure you've probably got way more than three. So just putting you on the spot a little bit there, Andy. What's your three leadership essentials?
Well, as you said, John, we've probably touched on these, but I think number one is this: the starting point of any relationship is one of mutual trust and respect. Without that, you're not going to be building on very secure foundations. So that's got to be the starting point, in my view. And that's relationships with colleagues as well as with suppliers and customers. Mutual trust and respect. And then secondly, it's about understanding and being able to rationalise your core values and principles. Again, what's your point of departure? What are you trying to achieve? And to make sure that you recruit and develop your team in line with those core values and principles. Because if you don't get that right, you'll recruit the wrong people and or they'll do things that are contrary to the core principles that you want to establish in your business. And then thirdly, again, something that we've touched on is this kind of leading from behind aspect. Give your team the space and the support to grow and develop their own style. Your responsibility as a leader is only to create an environment that helps them achieve their long-term career potential. And as I said before, one of the proudest things I've been involved in my career was seeing people that I've recruited go, you know, into leadership roles and go past me. That's great, fantastic. Because they had that potential in them. And thankfully, we were able to create the environment where they met their potential and fulfilled themselves, not just in the workplace, but it spreads much, much wider than that. So they would be my three.
Love them. Absolutely fantastic. Where would people be able to get hold of you? As I say, I'll put some links in the show notes, but just where will people be able to get hold of you if they're interested in chatting to you further?
Just on LinkedIn, John. Yeah, that would be the best place. My fledgling consultancy company has been established, but I've not got to the stage of creating a website yet. So by all means, if people are interested in reaching out, LinkedIn would be the place to do it.
Fantastic.
Thank you so much for your time, Andy. Learned a lot on that incredible conversation, and what a story.
Thanks, Rachel, and thanks for inviting me on. It's not something I've done before, but I hope that that's of use to your listeners and to Scaffold. So thanks for the opportunity.
Absolutely, Andy. I knew that you wouldn't disappoint in any way, or shape or form. So thanks ever so much. It's great to chat to you again.
Thank you so much for listening to the Building Better Leaders podcast. We hope you've got a lot out of this. If you'd like to read up a bit more on any of the content that you've heard in today's podcast, be sure to check out our website, scaffoldcoaching.com.